Hello and welcome to the Chicago Songwriter Podcast. This is the sixth episode. I had a little bit of break for the summer, but we're back. And I have with me today Dean Milano. How you doing, Dean?
I'm doing just darn fine.
Great. Good to have you here.
What the heck?
So we like to start the show off with the first section, learning a little bit about you and maybe where you grew up and how long you've been playing music and stuff. So I'm guessing, looking at your CD here, there's some pictures that I think are you.
Oh, yeah.
As a kid playing an accordion and some other music. And
that accordion that you see in that picture of me when I was 10 years old, that accordion is the one that's played on the CD.
Oh, great.
Same accordion.
Now, do you still play it?
Oh, yeah. It's like I said, it's played on the CD. I play it on the CD. Nice. And it's on my new CD, too. I play it again. Yeah.
So was that your first instrument, accordion?
Yeah, it probably was, I guess. That was about 1960, and I was like 9 years old. And that was my first instrument. And I love the accordion. I still love it. I think it's a beautiful instrument. The sounds are so great. I'm so glad that people like Garth Hudson and those guys, you know, brought it back again and made it credible again. Because it had been dismissed as a joke for so many years, you know. But it is a beautiful instrument. I just love the accordion.
Very versatile. I have two accordions, actually. I'm not that great at it. But, I mean, in world music, it's very, you know, universal.
Sure.
Irish and German and Polish and Italian and French. Right. I mean, go across the whole thing.
And in the song, the new song I've got on my new CD, which is not yet, I play the accordion on a song that is very Irish.
Nice.
I said, it's got to have the accordion in it. I wrote a song that's kind of like an Irish tune, so I put the accordion in that one. It's perfect.
Awesome. Nice. Yeah. I heard recently Sheryl Crow say that she thinks the accordion is the sexiest instrument out there.
Is that right?
So, yeah. You know, maybe you'll be getting a call from Sheryl Crow someday.
I'd like to hear that.
Yeah. So, did you grow up in a musical family?
Yeah, my uncle Connie Milano was a famous bass player. Played with Charlie Parker and a lot of major jazz names back in the 50s and so on. He still plays. He's still a player, yeah. And my aunt was a violist with the Milwaukee Symphony. And my mother is an actress and a singer. Not a professional actress, really, but, you know, community theater. But she's doing that for 40 years, and she's a great singer. Mm-hmm. My cousins are all musicians. My brothers are players. So I guess it is a pretty musical family, yeah.
So did you grow up in Milwaukee?
Yeah, born and raised in Milwaukee. And I lived there till I was 13 and absolutely loved it. I mean, my memories of Milwaukee are just fantastic. And they're in one of the songs that I'll do later on. And then we moved to Chicago in 1964 when I was 13 years old. And I still feel like I'm a Milwaukee kid. You know? And I still feel like I'm a foreigner here in Chicago. I don't belong here. I should be in Milwaukee.
Do you make it back up to Milwaukee?
Oh, yeah. I've got tons of relatives there.
Yeah.
I'm there all the time. Yeah. In fact, I just wrote a song called Up Wisconsin Way, which is a little ballad about me traveling up to Wisconsin and just driving around in northern Wisconsin. That's my newest song. I just love Wisconsin. So it's where my heart is, really is.
So now, when did you start writing songs?
You know, my first song I think I wrote when I was about 15, back in 1966, when I was in my first rock band, you know, and I wrote some corny rock songs. And one of them, what was it called? What Will People Say When They, you know, What Will People Say When They See That We're In Love, or something like that. It was a goofy little song, but that was my first one. And then I got more serious in the early 70s. I was down in Carbondale and going to SIU, and I had a band down there. I started writing some rock and roll songs for that band. And a couple of those songs I'm putting on my new CD, in fact, as bonus tracks.
Nice.
Yeah, they're songs that I wrote back in the early 70s.
So now in the mid-60s, were you influenced by, like, the Beatles or Bob Dylan or the Stones?
Well,
you know,
the little bit of writing, the little bit of writing I did in the mid-60s, I don't think, you know, they were just pop tunes that were influenced by what was going on top 40 radio at that time, you know. But, of course, later, yes, the Beatles influenced me, definitely, yeah. You know, in my writing.
They're a great influence, I guess.
Oh, they have to be. People, I mean, I would say my top influences I've got on my list here were Bob Dylan and Lennon McCartney. And anybody who tries to deny that they haven't been influenced by those guys has got to be deaf. I mean, you can't say that you weren't influenced by them. They are the masters of pop, folk music. They really are, you know.
So I'm looking at your CD again, and I see, you know, it looks like a timeline from a little child up until the present, and it looks like music is a part of your life every step of this way.
Oh, pretty much, yeah.
So you were a bass player?
Yeah, I am a bass player.
Or am still.
I'm not really a guitar player. I just took up the guitar in the last couple of years because I'm writing all these songs, and I have to be able to play. I can't bring a bass on stage and play. So I've had to learn the guitar, you know, but I'm really a bass player, yeah.
And so we talk about as a teenager, you were in a rock band, and you mentioned to me right before we came on here that you've been playing even professionally and as a living for a big chunk of your life.
Oh, sure. About 20 years I was doing it full time, back when you could do that, you know. And then things kind of dried up as far as venues that you could play. It all kind of disappeared, and there's not much left, unfortunately. So, you know, a lot of the guys that I know that were full-time have given up now, and they're still playing, but we're all just playing for fun now.
Yeah. You know, so. Can you walk us through maybe the evolution from your teenage bands up until...
Yeah, sure. I rock bands in the 60s, of course, starting in 66, and a couple of them were really good. I mean, I was in some great rock bands back in those days. And then
what kind of rock at that time were they?
The one band I had was called Grope, and that was from 67 through 69, and we did a lot of Hendrix, Cream, Doors, Grateful Dead, some Zappa, Kinks, stuff like that, you know, stuff that was, we were a little bit, you know, out of the box. We didn't play the standards. We played the stuff that was considered underground music in those days, psychedelic, of course, and underground music, where you'd get the FM stations on your radio like after midnight, and they'd be playing the underground music, you know, like the long version of Light My Fire. They would play that, and that was real. You know, you had to tune in after midnight to find that stuff in those days, and that's the kind of stuff. And now I think they call that AOR, album oriented rock or something. Yeah. That didn't exist back then, but that's what that music was.
The Deep Cuts. Think on XM, there's a channel called Deep Cuts that goes.
Is that right? And that's what we were interested in playing in those. We didn't want to play the top 40 popular songs. We wanted to play the real obscure stuff. And it was a good band, really was. Yeah. And then from there, I went down to SIU to Carbondale to go to school down there. And I had several bands down there. And at that point, I also started getting into country music, too. Mm-hmm. And after about 1970, 71, I didn't like the direction that rock and roll was going at all. It just wasn't appealing to me. The heavy metal stuff was coming in. Mm-hmm. And I was a major fan of Hendrix. I mean, I saw Hendrix live and up close and everything, you know, and Led Zeppelin and those bands. And the beginning of heavy metal, I really thought it was great. But the direction it ended up going in, I didn't care for. So I started getting more into country and bluegrass music.
Yeah.
But I was still playing rock and roll. And I had a rock and roll band called Pontiac Jones down in Carbondale, which eventually morphed into Big Twist and the Mellow Fellows years later.
Really?
After I left them, though, yeah. But that was the band I had down there. That was the rock band I started. And then I had a bluegrass band called Scuttlebucket Band, which played all folk, country, bluegrass stuff. And so I was doing both things at one time. And a lot of the same guys were in each band. So we could go into a club. We could do a whole set of traditional bluegrass with the traditional instruments and then take a break and switch and come back and do rock and roll all night long.
So what were you playing in the bluegrass band?
Your string stand-up bass. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And then you might come back and play the electric bass in your rock band.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I think you can hear the influence of a lot of different types of music on music and on your CD.
Yeah, because I love all styles of music. You know, I have to say I'm not into rap and hip hop and stuff, but at 56 years of age, most of us aren't. But I love all styles of music, and it's reflected on that CD. There's Latin, there's jazz, there's folk, country, bluegrass, rock, pop. Now my new CD has got all that, plus it's got Cajun and Irish, and you know. And if people say, well, "What are you trying to do here?" You know, settle on one style. I'm like, "Well, sorry, I love all those styles, and that's what I want to do." And I write in all those styles.
That's who you are, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
So when is your new CD going to be coming out?
It should be out after the new year.
Oh, great.
Yeah, we just put the final tracks on last Friday, and now we're into the mixing process. And it sounds great. I mean, I just love what we got on this CD. And I tell people, if they thought this CD was not commercial, the new one's even less commercial.
Well, if the new CD is half as good as this one, I think everyone should have a copy.
Well, I think it is. I'm really happy with it, yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about, you said you started writing songs in the mid-60s, and you're obviously still writing and going strong today. Mm-hmm. How have you seen your evolution there as a songwriter?
Well, like I said, I started writing a little more seriously in the early 70s, and then I wrote, by that point on, I'd write like one or two songs a year, or maybe I'd skip a few years, and I wrote about maybe a dozen songs until about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I don't mean about a dozen songs, but until about 2 years ago. Because I had this feeling that I could only write a song if something came to me like a bolt of lightning or something. Yeah. And I'd say, oh, I got, you know, that was the wrong way to go about it.
Waiting for the music.
Yeah, I was waiting.
Do this.
Right. And that was the mistake. I shouldn't have waited, because then I buckled down about 2 years ago. But I was hearing a lot of CDs coming out that were singer-songwriter CDs that I thought were actually pretty mediocre, you know. And I'm like, boy, all these people are writing all this music and putting these CDs out. And I don't have a CD. I think I could do that. I'm going to start getting serious about writing again. So I started writing again about 2 years ago. And I started sitting down and saying, I'm going to write a song today. I've got an idea. And I was pushing myself. And now I've written 30 songs in the past 2 years.
Wow, that's great.
After writing 12 in the first 25 years, you know, I wrote 30 in the last 2 years. So
does that kind of coincide, those timelines, with your showing up at the Old Town School on the
No, that happened later.
Okay.
Yeah, I started finding out about that stuff later. I started at the Old Town School about a year and a half ago, maybe a year or whatever. It was a little bit after I was getting the CD rolling, basically. Yeah, I was pretty much on my own with the writing, and I, you know, started finding out more. I started deciding to hit the open mics and to see what's out there, because I had been very divorced from the whole folk music scene in Chicago for a long time, because I was heavily into it in the 70s. I had a band called the Casualaires that played the Lincoln Avenue circuit up and down every night. We played Troubles and Earls and the Bulls and Orphans and all those clubs constantly. And then the circuit started kind of drying up about the early 80s, and things weren't happening as much. The clubs were closing. And I said, well, if I'm going to play music for a living, I'm going to have to get on something else. So I got into the country western circuit and the rock and roll circuit and some of the dinner theater circuit. And I was making good money playing, but I wasn't on the folk circuit anymore at all, you know. But then the last few years, all the circuits dried up and I couldn't really make money in it anymore. And I said, well, if I can't make money at this anymore, I'm making money doing something else, I'm going to go back to what I really always loved doing, which was playing folk music. Yep. So I started weeding my way back into the Chicago folk scene again and found a whole lot of people that I had known back then, people I hadn't seen in like 25 years, and they're still out there playing. And it was, we had some great little reunions, and it was really fun, especially at the Tom D. Memorial Concert at the Old Town School. I went to that, and boy, it was like just old times again, running into everybody that I hadn't seen in so many years, and it was just really, really, really nice. It was a sad event to be... Yeah, it happened at, but it happens to be that's coincidental.
Blast from the past, huh?
Yeah, it really was. It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
Well, can we ask you to play a song for us?
Yeah, sure.
What are you going to play for us?
Well, this is the leadoff song on my CD, Songs About Stuff, my first CD, which came out last January. This is called Flashes of Brilliance, and it's gotten a lot of radio airplay. So apparently, somebody out there likes DJs too. Flashes of brilliance, a painting, a rhyme. It might only happen once in a lifetime. But if that flash is the best thing that they'll ever do, sets them apart from me and you. We all know the song about the day the music died. Something made it special, no one knew quite why. Singing bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Everybody sang along, and they're still singing it today. In 1961, a new book lands on the charts. His words might set the world on fire, but he disappears before it starts. So when things don't go just the way you want them to, you shake your head, you call it a catch-22. And if you're wondering why you just said that, look to the sky and tip your hat to those flashes of brilliance. Flashes of brilliance. Critics snarl and the critics sneer. Looks like another one-hit wonder here. While that critic moves on to the next big thing, without even thinking about it, he begins to sing an old forgotten song from many years ago. When he was a kid, he used to hear it on the radio. He could never write the song, no matter how he tried. So write that song, you gotta feel something inside, like those flashes of brilliance. Flashes of brilliance. Flashes of brilliance, a painting, a rhyme. Might only happen once in a lifetime. But if that flash is the only thing that they'll ever do, it still sets them apart from me and you. Flashes of brilliance, like a diamond on a black velvet sleeve, lightning on a warm September eve. Flashes of brilliance.
Very nice.
Thank you.
So how did you come up with the idea for that song?
Well, it's probably kind of obvious in the lyrics. I was thinking about all these people who come up with, one great thing. In fact, I saw that film, Beautiful Mind, which is the story of John Nash, mm-hmm. who came up with this economic theory. If you've seen the film.
Yeah.
It's economic theory that changed the way economics have been viewed ever since he did that. And that was really, I think, the only one thing that he ever did. And then he just kind of faded away and didn't do much else after. But he did that one thing, you know. And I'm thinking, you know, no matter how much of a nobody he became or how much they wanted to blast him because he didn't do anything, he did that one thing. And
right.
you and I, we didn't do that. He did
right.
it.
Yeah.
He did it. And he is known for that. And he changed the world. And someone like, you know, Don McLean had that song American Pie, and of course he had some follow-ups, Vincent and stuff, which were very good songs, but that one song has become an American icon now.
Yeah.
He did it with that one song, and if he never did anything else, he did something that we couldn't do. You know, and Joseph Heller wrote Catch 22,
yeah.
and he got screamed at because he never wrote anything else really that ever had the kind of effect as that book,
yeah.
but that one book, major piece of literature in history now, you know.
Yeah.
That was his flash of brilliance, you know. And so no matter how someone wants to put those people down and call them one-hit wonders or whatever, they did it and we didn't. And that's why I wanted to give them a little credit, I guess, is what I was doing there.
Yeah. You know, so. It's nice how it kind of, incorporates pop culture and mm-hmm. events that people can relate to.
Right.
You know, I remember listening to that song on the CD the first time I popped it in, and it immediately caught my attention, you know, with the American Pie and
right.
the part, especially, hey, let's all sing along.
Yeah, know? And they do. And teenage kids still get together, and they all sing that song. I mean, so he's affected all those generations with that one song. And it's a song that I'm not even that crazy about. I like the song. I'm not insane about it, but I can see what it did. And, I am perceptive enough to realize that what he did was pretty important there.
Yeah,
you know,
I went to the University of Illinois, and there used to be a bar there, and every night at midnight, they would play that song.
Oh, yeah.
And that was, you know, even when I was there, it was 20 years later after
yeah,
the song. So
sure.
it's just amazing. I mean, I think they still do it. So,
yeah.
you know, here we're 30, 40 years away.
And, yeah, talk about lasting power. I mean,
and every night at midnight, they're doing that.
Yeah.
That's one place. Lord knows around the country. You
oh,
know,
yeah,
what they're doing.
Sure. Yeah. Every writer would dream of something like that.
Yeah.
You know, have his piece become a part of cultural history, basically.
I like the part in there, too, about, I think this is easy to criticize, and it's tough to do. So,
yeah.
you know, here's this guy, the critic,
mm-hmm.
and he's never going to have his flash of brilliance,
right.
I guess. But he's easy to, you know, make fun of somebody else's
yeah.
or say, well, why did you only have one of these or something?
Yeah, right. And then he catches himself singing one of those songs, and it's like, hey, there you go. You know, you're singing that song, and that was that guy's flash of brilliance, and it obviously affected you.
Yeah.
You know, so.
That's a great song.
Thank you.
So let's talk about in this part of the show a little bit about how you write songs.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you started hinting to that early on, where you said, "Hey, early in your life, you would wait for this
yeah.
thing just to come knocking on your door." Now
yeah.
maybe you're looking at little, you know, ideas and proactively chasing them down and working them a little bit.
Yeah, I've had certain ideas going through my mind for years that I always wanted to put into song form and just never got around to doing it. And then finally, I said, "I'm gonna." Take these ideas and use them. And one of them is a song on my new album called Sacrificial Lambs that it was a thing I had been kicking around in my head for years and years, and that was about people who become so famous and so popular that their private lives become sacrificed, basically,
mm-hmm.
and they can never have a normal life again. And in some cases, like a Britney Spears or something, I'm sure that she loves that, you know. But then you've got great artists, and Dylan went through this, where
yeah.
his life was almost ruined. If you read his book Chronicles, he talks about it, you know. And I started feeling sorry for that. You know, it's hard to feel sorry for multimillionaires who are famous and popular, but to an extent, some of them are pretty miserable and
yeah.
driven to suicide in some cases, you know. And I that was kicking around in my mind that these people are the sacrificial lambs of our culture and our society, and we are allowed to enjoy the great works that they create, but they have to suffer with the fact that their lives are ruined. And I said, I've got to get this into a song somehow. So it's on the new CD called Sacrificial Lambs, and I hope I got my point across. I don't know. And it's a subject that I don't think is tackled that often.
Yeah.
I don't hear it talked about that much. I think it's important.
I've always thought if to be a celebrity, maybe the best kind of celebrity would be like a songwriter or even an author.
That you're not recognized.
Yeah, because you can, right. You know, you can get that attention from having done something critical and, mm-hmm. you know, you can make some money at it and everything right. else. But you could probably also walk down Michigan Avenue
yeah.
any time of day and people aren't knows. Jumping you, you know, like.
Exactly.
Right. You see Michael Jordan or, you know, right. the Beatles or Elvis or, you know, yeah. Dylan in their day. Jeez. Enough's enough. Huh?
Yeah, but those are ideas that I've had kicking around in my mind for years, and then I finally said I'm going to get these into a song because I want to make people think about certain things and maybe talk about them. Flashes of Brilliance is an example right there. That's yeah. a subject that you could sit down now with a few people and you could have a roundtable discussion about what was talked about in that song.
Yeah,
and not so much that it's a great song, but it is an idea. That needs to be discussed, you know, as opposed to just I love you, baby, you love me, you know, yeah, which is why I don't write love songs too often, you know. Once in a while I write a love song, but there's enough of those done, you know. Yeah. I'd rather get to something, go on and move on to something else, you know. So that's how I write my songs. And people always say, oh, what comes first, the words or the music? And I'm like, well, there's no set way. And there are times when all of a sudden this neat little melody will come into my head. I said, oh, I got to get the tape recorder. I like that. Okay, look, these chords would work with that. Oh, that's pretty cool. Let me file that away, and I'm going to use that for something later on.
Yeah.
Other times, I'll get an idea for a topic like Flashes of Brilliance, and I'll say, you know, Flashes of Brilliance, a painting, a rhyme, might only happen once in a lifetime. Oh, I like that. I'm going to write that down. I can use that someplace, and then I'll start with that, you know.
And then expand it from there?
Exactly, right, right.
So do you have a notebook of ideas that you?
Well, you know, we all had notebooks. Now we have computers. You know, so. Yeah,
metal notebook or
yeah, in the yeah. But everything goes into the computer, and I've got a document called Song Ideas, and it's just got a list of little ideas that I have for future songs, and some of them I get stuck on. I mean, I want to write a song about my grandfather who I loved dearly, and he died about 10-15 years ago. But, you know, it's like, well, everybody's got a song about their grandfather or their dad or their grandmother. I'm like, how am I going to come up with one that's not just another song about your grandfather, you know?
Right.
And I still haven't come up with an idea how I can do that yet. You know, I've got to figure out some way where I can write a song about him, showing how much I loved him, but not just another one of these, I loved my grandfather and we would sit around and do this and that. You know? So that's the prize. So I'm stumped on that one. It's been a year or two now and I haven't been able to go anywhere with it, you know? It's on that idea list, you know.
Yeah. So it sounds like you do something maybe kind of similar to what I do. I'll get some ideas, and I wish something would happen with it. And if nothing's happening, it, I don't really usually force it. I just kind of let it brew in the back of my mind or something. Do you do that as well?
Oh, sure. And then once in a while, you know, you'll go back and you'll see that on that page, and you'll say, "Oh, that one, yeah." And then you'll get an idea from the reverse.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Let's stick that in there, you know. And you never know when something's going to come to you.
Kind of evolves in its own time frame, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And then a lot of the ideas will come from news events and stuff too. I mean, I wrote this song called "Forever Children,"
mm-hmm.
that has references to Katrina and what happened in New Orleans with the breaking of the levee and stuff. And of course, that stuff. I was watching that on my computer on CNN. They were updating by the hour, and I kept logging in and seeing what was happening as that hurricane was developing down there. And I eventually, you know, started writing it into a song, and it developed into Forever Children, which became actually an anti-war song in the end.
Right.
Which is getting a lot of play all around the world now because other countries are upset about this war, and they're hearing a song of mine called Forever Children, and a lot of stations around the world have been playing it, I've noticed. It surprised me.
So on some of your songs where there's, you know, I think a lot of them on here, there's a lot of nostalgia and stuff in. Do you create like a list of here's all the things I'd like to try to work in here and then see what fits, or do they just all seem to fit?
Yeah, a lot of times when you're roughing a song out, I'll just have like lines like, you know, the smell of chocolate milk, the smell of my old teacher's perfume in fifth grade, you know, and it'll just be listed like that. Yeah. And then as I'm writing a song, then I'm like, okay, now how can I make that rhyme? How can I incorporate that in? You'll hear it in the one song I'll do later.
That's the Time Machine song.
Time Machine, yeah. Right? How can I incorporate that into the song now? You know, but it starts out with just lists like that. And sometimes the whole song can start out as just a story with no rhyme at all to it.
Right.
You know, like, you know, I'm going to take a vacation out west, but I'm not going to take Route 80. I'm going to take, you know, the back roads. And it's just written like that. And then I start at the top and say, okay, I was complaining to a friend of mine. And then all of a sudden I'll rhyme that line. And I'll go to the next one. Now, how can I rhyme this line? You know, and then slowly it will become rhyme. And then it's finished as a song.
Yeah.
You know? Starting out as a block story. And it develops into a song just that way, you know. So,
do you think, if you had to say, are you more of a word guy or a music guy? Or
I hope I'm both.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember one time I was at a songwriting circle thing, and one of the guys that I played a bunch of my songs said, man, you have such a way with lyrics and melody. Yeah. And I thought, well, isn't that exactly what you want? I mean, those are the two important elements of the song, lyrics and melody. If you got both of those, right. I guess you're doing okay. So, I hope that I'm dealing with both on an equal level, because I love to have interesting music. And you can write a song that's got interesting lyrics, but if the music isn't that interesting, you might start to lose your listener.
Absolutely. You
know? Yeah.
I mean, I think that's one thing I struggle with. I think I'm better word writer than music writer. Right. And so that's something I'm trying to work on. How do I develop that? And I think you're right. The epitome is to have great words and great music. Yeah. But I was just curious if you felt... if you were better at one or the other or not. I think you're good at both. I mean, I'm not...
thanks. Yeah, I know that, like, with the lyrics, I have learned that you want to have an opening line that will grab your listener right away.
Yeah.
You know, and when I hear a song that says, I woke up in the morning and my darling was gone and I miss her so much. Well, that guy's lost me already. I really don't care, you know. So I'm thinking that every opening line of my song, I'm going to try and get it to be something that's interesting enough. And I did a song circle the other night, and I played one of my songs Up Wisconsin Way. And the opening line is, sometimes this old world gets me down, puts my face in a permanent frown. And he said to me, he says, man, he says, you hooked me with that line immediately. He said, I wanted to know what was about this permanent frown. I said, okay, well, then I guess I succeeded there. I got the guy in right away to listen to the song, and hopefully he's going to want to hear the whole thing, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what I've discovered. And then you've got to evolve your story so that it's you keep them wanting to know what's going to happen at the end of this story, you know.
Yeah.
And the new album's got a couple of those stories that are like that. It's like you really want to know, wow, what's going to happen at the end? You don't want to lose interest in the song. You want to hear it all the way to the end. That's the hardest thing about writing lyrics. It really is hard to do that, you know.
But I think you're right. I mean, it's like a good book. If you pick up a book and it's got a really boring beginning or a slow start, you may never get to the good stuff.
Exactly.
You got to get them hooked, right?
Yeah, it's a trick. It's a trick that you have to learn how to do. Yeah.
One thing I give you a lot of credit for, I'm looking at, your CD and... You know, most of the songs are about clocking in at 3 to 3.5 minutes.
Yeah.
Which,
it's hard to do too.
It's tough to get somebody hooked, tell the story, and get out of there in 3 minutes. Yeah. But I have to say, it shows to me, some real craft and some editing.
Yeah, I've had to edit whole verses out.
Yeah.
That I really liked, but I'm like, I can't keep. Because the worst thing is, we go to these open mics, these song circles, and you'll get, a lot of times the younger people will come in and they haven't figured that out yet. And their songs are like 6 minutes long.
Right.
And a lot of it's just repeating the same thing over and over. And you're like, you really got to pare that down.
That's right.
Because you're going to lose your listener pretty quick if it's going to go on and on like that. So that's the hardest part about these songs. And some of them are a little bit too long. But they've all gotten radio airplay, which surprised me. Because some of them I thought were going to be way too long, but they've all been played on the radio, which is a nice thing too, is, when you do a CD and you send it to the stations, you would hope that all the stations just aren't going to pick out one or two songs that they think are the best. But on this CD, they have played virtually everything on the CD on these stations multiple times. And that makes me feel like, okay, it's not just an album that has one or two strong songs and everything else is garbage. Apparently, people seem to think that it's a worthwhile CD all the way through, which is good.
That's great. I mean, I think the longest song I'm looking at here is like in about 5 minutes, which... By today's standards, isn't really even that long.
Yeah.
But you know, I think as you talked about growing up in the 60s and 70s, I mean, there used to be like this magic, like 3 minute mark, right?
Right. Oh, yeah.
If you wanted to hear the long version of Light My Fire,
yeah,
you had
to wait until after midnight. And I think it was Hey Jude that broke that tradition.
That's at about a 7 minute.
Whatever it was, it was long, yeah. And it was number one hit. It was one of the biggest hits for decades. You know,
yeah.
It was the biggest selling song for a long time. So obviously, a great song can get away with it, you know, but that's hard to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now, how do you, let's talk a little bit about editing when you're writing, because I think that's one thing I struggle with and maybe a lot of songwriters struggle with.
Yeah.
Is, you know, once you get the juices going, then, you know, sometimes you're looking at there going, how am I going to fill up one page? And other times you're like, oh, geez, now what do? I got 5 pages.
Yeah.
How do I manage that and tell my story and make it listen?
Yeah.
How do you do that?
I look at all the lines and I say, is there anything that I've said here that I'm saying it again a little bit later in a little bit different way, but I'm really saying the same thing?
Yeah.
And if that's the case, I've got to figure out how to take the elements from both of those lines and mesh them into one and say the same thing in one line. And I'm surprised at myself when I'm able to do that sometimes. I'm like, wow, how did I do that? You know? And in fact, in general, I've talked to some other songwriter friends of mine, and I said to them, you ever get that thing when you go back and you look at the lyrics you've written like a month later and you say, man, did I write that?
Yeah.
Where did I come up with that? I don't know where that came from. What was that? What was I smoking? I don't smoke. You know, what was I dreaming or what? But sometimes I'm shocked at the stuff that I do come up with. It's very surprising. But yeah, that is hard, editing. That's one of the hardest things. It really is. Because you think you've got all these great verses in your song, and I can't take any of that out. It's all so great. Well, you know, the 3-minute songwriters are able to do it. And that's when Dylan was one of my influences. He was able to say so much in one line. He could take 7 or 8 words and he could say what you could say in a novel in one line. I'm like, how does that guy do that? I've got to figure out how to do that. And I don't think I've quite figured it out yet, but I'm always working on it. I'm always trying to figure out how he did that. You know?
Do you think that's partly the difference between good songwriters and great songwriters?
Oh, sure. That's where your craftsmanship comes in and your prose come in. And, you know, you go to a songwriter circle or an open mic and you hear the amateurs versus the pros, and you can pick them out right away. And you say, yeah, this person here has got some good stuff, but they haven't reached that level yet. They're not a Michael Smith yet, you know, or whatever, or an Al Day. You know, they'll get there, but they're not quite there yet.
So, right. You know. Well, can you play for us a second one?
Yeah, sure.
What are you going to play for us next?
Let's play Take the Blue Highway. This is a song about my passion, which is just jumping in my car and getting on the open road and seeing what's out there to see and taking all the back roads and getting off the interstates completely. In fact, my brothers and I went all the way to California a few years back on all back roads. We avoided interstates almost all the way. Nice. Because the back roads is where you see the really interesting stuff. You
right.
know, the interstates are boring. And I remember seeing, I think it was John Candy was on Johnny Carson's show one night, or Leno or something. And John Candy said, you know, we decided to take a cross-country vacation with the family because when I was a kid, that's what we used to do. And I used to love that so much. Well, you know, we got on Route 80 and it was boring. It was the most boring trip. And I don't know why I thought that was so much fun. And I thought to myself, well, John, that's what you missed. You didn't take Route 80 because Route 80 didn't exist back then. You took the back roads and that's why it was so interesting.
Right.
So then I started working on this little tune, you know, years later, of course, because John Candy's been dead a long time. But, you know, eventually that's what made me think about that whole thing. I said, that's what people don't get, is you don't take Route 80 across. You know, if you've got time, you don't always, if you got time, get on those blue highways.
Yeah.
And that's where the neat stuff is. And all the stuff that I've discovered on those highways is just, you know, and that's what this song is about. It's called Take the Blue Highway. I was complaining to a friend of mine just the other night. Seems my cross-country dream vacation hadn't turned out right. Told him how I loaded up my brand new Chevrolet and proceeded down Route 80 just to see the USA. But everything looked different from my childhood memory. That road stretched on forever with nothing much to see. And every time we got off at another exit ramp, it was a Texaco McDonald's and a KOA camp. Well, my friend, he took one look upon the map that I had read. Do you want to know the secret? This is what he said. You take the blue highway, you might just be surprised. Take the blue highway, where the magic never dies. old fine Route 66. The Dixie and the Lincoln, well, the old road still exists, and it's more like what you're thinking, more like what you're thinking. Well, if it's just the same old places, I can't see that anywhere. What's this magic that you're talking about? He began to glare. If you look a little closer, you'll discover what I mean. You'll find the roadside and the folks who keep it like it used to be. Well, these are people who are hanging on with every breath they've got, trying to save this country's history before it goes to rot. There's a new disease that's creeping out across the USA, and if our towns all look the same, that's an awful price to pay. So take the blue highway. You might just be surprised. Take the blue highway, where the magic never dies. Old fine Route 66, the Dixie and the Lincoln, well, the old road still exists, and it's more like what you're thinking, more like what you're thinking. So I loaded up the Chevy with my friend's philosophy. Seems the places and the people on the highways were the key. Now with every new adventure, it's still getting inside me. I guess the back roads of America is where I need to be. I took the blue highway, and I was damn surprised. I took the blue highway, where the magic had died. I found Route 66, the Dixie and the Lincoln, well, the old road still exists. Yes, the old road still exists, and it suits my way of thinking. Suits my way of thinking.
I like that one.
Oh, thank you.
Very catchy. I catch myself singing that one.
Oh, is that right? Well, that's a good sign. Yeah.
Let me ask you something about on the CD. The arrangements on there, I think, are just great.
Oh, thank you.
So do you do that, or who do you work with to do that?
No, that's all my stuff. I produce it, basically.
So the harmonies, the...
Well, I harmonize most of the songs myself out there.
There's
a female that sings on, Amberlee Hayes sings on, I think, three of the songs, and I just told her what to sing, basically. But yeah, what you hear on there is what I've arranged. Now, Don Sternberg came in on guitar for me, and some of the parts that he plays, I actually told him what to play. I said, "These are the notes I want to hear right here." And a lot of it, his own solo is his, because the guy's a fabulous guitar player. You know, Greg Cahill plays banjo on Blue Highway, and that opening lick he plays, the little waterfall, doodle, 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 I pretty much said note for note, this is what I want. You know, so they're playing what I tell them to play, and but of course I can't play this stuff, so I need to bring them in to do it for me, and they do a beautiful job on it. But no, I do all the arranging on all these, and I write all the harmonies and everything else. I had a co-producer named Dennis Gordon who helped me on this CD, but unfortunately he had a heart attack and died last February, and now he's gone. So the new CD I'm producing completely by myself. But I don't know why people think that they need to bring an outside producer in for a CD. I haven't found anything yet that I couldn't do myself producing my CDs. I'm not sure why I would need anyone else to come in and do it. I seem to be able to do it all myself, so I'm not sure what the mystery is there, you know. But
so as part of the songwriting process, so I take like the Blue Highway or something like that, you know, where there's just these incredible mandolin, banjo parts, harmonies, fiddles. I mean, it's really great bluegrass and going to your bluegrass roots. Do you hear all that when you're writing that song?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it's funny, too, because a lot of times I'll write the song and I hear all the parts in my head from the get-go. And then we'll go in the studio and we'll just put the scratch tracks on of, say, me on the rhythm guitar and my vocal and bass, maybe. And it can be months before the rest of those pieces get on there. And I'm hearing all those. Every time we're doing a playback on that, I'm hearing all those parts. And finally, when they get on there and they sound the way I had envisioned it, with a great violinist and a great banjo, I'm like, yeah, that's what I wanted to hear on this song. Now it's complete, you know. That's the fun part of it all. It really is. Yeah. When you finally hear those pieces on there that you've heard in your mind for all these months.
Yeah.
And now you hear them on the song. And it's like, that's how I've envisioned it. And a lot of times it's great because the engineers that are there and stuff will say, wow, you know, all this time we've heard that song, I never understood what you were doing, but now that you've got the pieces on it, it's like, now I get what you wanted to do. Now it makes sense. This is great. And I'm like, yeah, see, it was all up in my head there. You know? So
I think that's quite a gift, I mean, to hear that whole arrangement and be able to do that.
It could be. And, you know, it's funny because I constantly have music in my head all the time. And people say to me, do you have an iPod? And I'm like, no. They say, I can't believe you don't have an iPod. I say, I have no need for an iPod. I've got a symphony going through my head all the time. Yeah. I constantly have music going through my head. All my favorite music is playing. I mean, as I'm sitting talking to someone, I can say, oh, the song is in my head right now. And I can tell you what it is. It's been in my head for 3 hours. You know,
yeah.
It never stops. And sometimes I'll go to bed at night with that song in my head. And I'll wake up in the morning and I'll say, oh, it's still there. It's still playing in my head, you know. So, no, I don't need iPods and stuff like that.
Now, do you write from the perspective of, you know, do you hear the bass parts first? I mean, a lot of your songs, I think, are driven by bass and by the chord changes and stuff that really come with bass.
I hear the melodies, and the chord changes harmonize the melodies.
Okay.
Is what it is. That's how I hear it, yeah. I try and, you know, I'll write a melody, and then I'll try and figure out chord changes that will harmonize that melody and make it sound more interesting. I could do, you know, I take the blue highway, da-da-da-da-da-da, I take the blue highway, da-da-da-da-da-da. Okay,
right.
That's fine. But you put that A minor in there all of a sudden, and now it's a whole different feel, you know.
Yeah.
And you've harmonized that melody against a different chord that's really brought it out. And I've discovered that in a lot of my songs. You write them with these real basic 1-4-5 chord changes, and later on you'll say, you know, what could I stick in there? What chord would go in there that would just pop that note out, and you find that chord, and all of a sudden it's like a whole new segment of the song. It's like, oh, okay, that's what makes it work now. Yeah.
So I think a good example of that is probably on Where Did All the Music Go?
The
jazz kind of chords and structure.
Yeah,
that
was a hard song to write.
Yeah.
That was very hard to write. And Don Sternberg does a beautiful job on that one, playing that one. But I actually had to practice that vocal over and over and over and learn how to sing it right. You know, where a song like Blue Highway, you can sing it once and you already know what it is.
Yeah.
But that song, I modulated it on every line. And I had to sit down with a guitar and I had to figure that vocal line out and I had to play it over and over and over and learn it, you know, by heart before I could finally go in the studio and record it. You know? It was a very difficult song to do, but I love the way it came out.
Oh, it's just amazing, and it really just adds another dimension to the whole CD. I mean,
hear
some of the bluegrass and the country, and now you're jazz, and it's a great small like jazz group arrangement. It's wonderful.
And I've played all that kind of music all my life in bands. I've been in probably 70 bands in my life.
No kidding.
And, oh, yeah. A lot of times you're in 3 or 4 bands at one time
in
order to get work. You know, and I've been in jazz groups. I mean, jazz quintets. I've been in 14-piece big bands.
Huh.
I've been in Cajun bands. I've been in bluegrass bands. And these are all authentic, too, you know.
Yeah.
So I've been in all those kinds of bands. I've played all that kind of music in bands. It's not like I'm just some guy who played folk music all his life and now he wants to try and play a jazz tune. No, I've played plenty of jazz in my life, you know. So this is music I love to play, and I wanted to include that in my CDs.
So let's talk a little bit about your influences then. You know, if you were going to create the Dean Milano Songwriter Hall of Fame, who would you want to see in there and why?
Well, the people I think we had mentioned, the top influences for me would be Bob Dylan and then Lennon McCartney.
Yeah.
And like I was saying before, anybody that's my age in my 50s, you know, you can't avoid, you know, being influenced by those guys because they were the masters of rock and roll and pop music. And what they did influenced all of us. It really did. I mean, you know, it's hard to just even talk about how much I did. It was so incredible, you know. And then going on from there, Robbie Robertson of the band.
Yeah.
I just love his writing. And, of course, you have to include the other band members with him because Danko and Helm and Garth and Richard Manuel, they all wrote in those songs too.
Yeah.
So it's the whole group effort they did. That's just some of those. They are my favorite band in the world.
And they were Bob Dylan's band, right?
They were his backup band.
Yeah.
And they are, to me, the best band in the world. I mean, bar none, they are the best, you know. Neil Young was a major influence in my stuff. I love his writing. And the fact that, you know, the guy started with Buffalo Springfield back in 66 writing, and here it is 2007, and he is still writing valid music. Who else is doing that?
Yeah.
You know?
He had a CD that just came out about a month ago.
Oh, yeah, and his stuff is great.
Yeah.
I mean, how many people can still do that and not burn out? You know, of course, Dylan is still writing, And Dylan, you know, his new stuff, some of it is great. A lot of it's kind of mediocre. You know. But Neil Young is still putting out great music after all these years. And then George Gershwin, Cole Porter.
All
major influences. I mean, God, Porter for his witty lyrics.
Incredible.
And sophisticated lyric writing. That was a real turning point for lyricists when he came along. You know, what he did was just astounding.
When I hear some of his stuff in the internal rhymes, I think he's like the master of, you know, putting rhymes in places you wouldn't even think of. Not just at the end of the line, but you can read some of his lines, and there might be three or four rhymes just in one line.
Amazing. I could never write the way he did. It was just incredible. And then George Gershwin, just for his fabulous melodies and the way they were harmonized, and the fact that he was one of the pioneers in bending the notes, and of course it had been done in the blues and everything before that, but he took it and he adapted it to jazz and pop and even symphonic orchestral music, instead of playing bom 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 bom, he would play bom 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 bom.
Yeah.
Bom, bom, da. It's like, whoa, it just changed the whole song all of a sudden, And I use a lot of that in my music too, I've got a song now called One Golden Moment, which opens my new CD. And it's definitely, the melody is influenced by Gershwin and what he was doing. Local guys, Michael Smith, his music has been a big influence on me. I love his music. In fact, this last song I'll play was very influenced by Michael. And John Prine, too, influenced me a lot. Just from that working class kind of, background that he came with. And it was his stuff was so conversational and just such everyday life images, And all these people create pictures with their music, which is what I want to do. I want to, when someone hears my song, I want them to be envisioning an actual image in their mind. I want to create images in their mind. That's the most important thing to me to do. Because the greatest writers do that for me. I've got Aaron Copland, Maurice Ravel, and Claude Debussy. Those are major influences because their music creates these beautiful images. I don't know how they can do it, but I can, when I'm listening to one of their pieces, I can picture scenes and vistas and everything. And boy, that's tough to do for a writer to do that. If you can do that, you are way ahead of the game, Frank Zappa is a major influence for me because Frank Zappa is one of the first people that actually orchestrated rock and roll music. He made it legit. He really did amazing things with rock music that nobody else was doing at the time at all. And so he's a big influence on me, apart from his lyrics too, which were always very witty and funny, and I love his lyrics. Woody Guthrie, big influence on me too, because he was one of the first people that made the music very personal. I mean, prior to that, you had, Tin Pan Alley and the pop songs that were basically love songs and cutesy songs, but all of a sudden Woody Guthrie comes along and he's making it like he's singing right to you, and you're sitting right with him on the porch, and the two of you are together, and he's singing this to you, and you felt that way. He did that to me, at least. I don't know if everyone else did the same effect, but I certainly did.
I know he had a big influence on Bob Dylan.
Oh, of course he did. Yeah, major influence.
Tracked him down. And
found him in New York,
Let's talk a little about the John Prine one, because there's a song on your CD, Just Another Whiny Song.
Oh, yeah.
And I can hear the John Prine influence in there, and I think that's a compliment, I mean, in fact, one of the things that really impresses me with John Prine and with some of your stuff is the sense of humor in there. Yeah. So it's funny, but it's not silly and that's tough. How do you do that? How do you walk a fine line between having the humor, but I think for good humor to stand up to repeat listenings, it can't just be like a joke and a punchline. It's got to be kind of witty and in there. And I think the whiny song is a great example of that.
Well, and Beer Cans and Beanie Babies.
Yeah, I was going to say that's another one too.
It's not as easy to write. I mean, humor is not easy to write. It's not easy to write funny stuff. I personally, I don't know how it happens. I mean, when I was writing those songs, those lines just kind of flowed out all of a sudden, and there they were, And I'm like, oh, that's funny, and I got to keep that because it's not easy to come up with a funny line. It really isn't. And I give credit to people who can write funny stuff, like Tom Lehrer and these guys, and it's like, wow, how do they do that? I couldn't do it. I can stand with a bunch of buddies of mine and make jokes and be funny, but when you got to sit down and try to be funny, write humor, that's pretty tough to do.
Tough,
And I don't have a lot of comedy songs on the CDs. There's a little bit of comedy in there. But I don't really focus on comedy because I don't think I'm that qualified.
I mean, that's what I'd say. This is what I respect. It's not comedy, but there's a sense of humor.
Humor, right. As opposed to laugh out loud screaming comedy.
It's not like Hello Mudder, Hello Fodder. Right. It's probably more of a silly joke song. I mean,
it's more the kind of thing that'll make you bring a smile to your face. Yeah. Like, oh, yeah, I know what he's talking about there. Okay.
And I think a lot of John Prine songs are like that, too. He works that in there a lot.
Sure.
Do you hear these influences in your music?
Oh, yeah, and the way I hear them, I want to always make sure that people can't say, well, that was influenced by John Prine, because I can hear his melody right there. You just stole from Hello In There or from Paradise. I'm like, no, no, you don't want that.
Right.
You don't want them to be able to pick out any line that can be attributed to that writer.
Right.
But you want to, you know, you want to take the essence of what you think they did.
Sure.
And create your own song with that. And then, of course, you want to take it to a different level, too. I mean, I've got a country song on there called In the Middle of Nowhere.
Right.
That, that steals a line from Puccini's opera Turandot. The main aria is, you know, that's the aria in Turandot. Well, now in mine, it's in the middle of nowhere. You know, now who would ever in a million years say you stole that from Puccini? You know, they would never put that together because now it's become a country song, you know.
Right.
But it was taken from Turandot, and that's how I use my influences. I'll take a line like that and I'll say, that is a great line with a great chord change. I'm going to figure out how I can work that into a song, but I'm going to change it enough that it's not the original song anymore. It's now it's a different level and it's a new song altogether. You know?
So on that song, I mean, that like guitar, which is almost like, you know, it reminds me of some of the early Clint Eastwood Westerns.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I wanted.
But it's amazing. I mean, it just sets the mood. That when I heard that CD for the first time, I actually hit rewind and listened to that song like 3 or 4 times in a row because I loved that.
Yeah.
Like, desolation type guitar.
That's what you want, exactly. Because you're out in the middle of Nevada and it's empty. And I have driven through, and that's a true story on that album.
Oh, really?
I mean, all these stories are true stories. I don't make these things up. These are things that have happened to me.
Yeah.
And there's stories in the new CD that are pretty shocking. They are true stories. But that actually happened to me, that story about in the middle of nowhere, that couple out there in the Nevada desert, you know. And I wanted to create this image of this great expansive desert just driving along. And radio stations out in Nevada and California have been playing this song. So they obviously like that idea. But yeah, and that guitar, I told my guitar player, Scotty Brown, played that, and I said, here's what I want. I want this, that old Clint Eastwood, Duane Eddy kind of a sound. And he was like, are you sure? Is that what you want? And he played and was done. He goes, man, he says, you were exactly right. That's exactly what it needed. It's perfect. You know? And I haven't gotten a lot of compliments on that. People have said, I love that guitar on that. And again, it's a case where, as great a guitar player as Scotty is, I told him exactly what to play on that note for note. I said, here's what you're going to play right here. You know, and he did it. He did a great job.
You know? You know how you're talking about setting up the right lyrics to hook people in. I think you can do that musically. Because when I heard that, I was thinking the same thing. Like, what is this song going to be about with that kind of an intro and that kind of a sonic grab my attention?
You know? You want to know
what's going to happen. I want to know what's coming next. Here, you know? Yeah. So that was great. Yeah. All right. Can we hear another song?
Yeah. Let me see if I'm still tuned.
Okay.
Because this song, you have to be tuned to play this one. I don't think it's tuned. It was not. Sorry, folks. this song is the song, when I wrote this song and I was done with it, I said, I don't ever have to write another song as long as I live, because this is a song I've always wanted to write. And I wrote it, and I love it. It's my favorite of all the songs I've written. It's I tried to portray my feelings about my childhood memories, basically, because my childhood and my whole life has been just a ball, to tell you the truth. I tell people, if I had one wish, I would like to live my whole life over again, and I wouldn't even change anything. I mean, it's just been so cool. I just had such a great life, and which is why, you know, I can't sing the blues because I didn't pay my dues. I've had too much fun. But I got to one point in my life where I was thinking about all these wonderful childhood memories and thinking to myself, did a lot of these things really happen, or did I imagine a lot of this stuff? And did I take things from childhood storybooks that had beautiful pictures in them, or did I take things out of, you know, movies that I saw, and did I imagine that I had experienced those things? And maybe I really didn't. I'm not sure, you know, because at that age, when you're younger, you're not sure what's influencing you. So I began to wonder how many of those memories really are my experiences and how many of them weren't, you know. So I gotta try to put that into words in a song somehow. So I tried it with this song, and I don't know if I succeeded or not. I think this song touches people on a lot of different levels, and a lot of them probably don't see it that way that I intended, but a lot of them come to me and they say, that song really affected me. I mean, it made me think about this and that. And I'm like, wow, that's great. That's what I want these songs to do. And I don't care if you got the message that I was trying to portray or not. as long as it affected you in some way, that's important.
Is this the Time Machine song?
This is the Time Machine, yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, from the listenings that I've had of this, this is really a mood piece. You know, it really sets a mood.
Mm-hmm. And it's supposed to set those images in your mind. I want to create images. And these are real images from my life that I'm trying to recreate, you know. The first one about looking out the window, that's all real. I mean, that's all real. And I'm trying to create that image that I had and see if anybody else can picture it the same way, you know.
Great, let's hear it.
Who knows if they did or not. Looking out your window, midnight snowstorm fills the air. Swirling round the street lights, and a ghostly wind is calling from somewhere. Could anything be more beautiful? Could anything be more alive? Maybe it was just a dream, but it's worth it when you arrive on your time machine. Summer days, and it's time for play on creaking swings that reach up to the sky. Flying through the air between the sheets that mother hangs like pure white clouds to dry. Could anything be more beautiful? The way the world's supposed to be. Pictures in a storybook of the moon, the clouds, the stormy sea, and your time machine. It all seems so perfect then, but does your memory play tricks on you? When you close your eyes and take the trip, does it matter if it isn't true? It isn't. Chocolate milk, or could it be perfume? Takes you back to a different time, takes you home, and a brightness fills the room. Could anything be more beautiful? But like smoke, it's all unraveling. The memories get hazy now. Possible you're traveling on your time machine.
Your favorite song that
you and the CD is cool because I got the violins on it.
It's wonderful.
It's really pretty.
It's really a mood piece, I think. Like, it really just sets a mood and pulls you in, and it's great.
I hope so.
I really like the line in there, did it really happen? Is it really true, or does it even matter?
Really matter. Yeah.
It's true, right?
Yeah, as long as you think it's true. As long as it's not making you crazy or something. It doesn't matter then, you know.
I think you're right on. I mean, I have childhood memories in my head sometimes, and then I look at a picture or hear my parents tell a story, and then I realize sometimes my memory, I think, is just shaped by what I've heard them say and what this photograph shows, but in my mind it feels real.
Yeah.
And that is the memory that I take from that.
Yeah.
And so, to your point, you know, I think if it feels true and it's that is your memory, then I think it becomes true, you know.
Yeah, it can become the memory, and then it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Well, that's great. Well, I want to say thank you for coming in today.
You're quite welcome.
I had a great time interviewing you. And let's talk about it. I'm lucky enough to have a copy of Songs About Stuff, but maybe if somebody out there is listening and they don't have one, how could they get one?
Well, the easiest way, of course, is to get it on CD Baby. It's okay. On CD Baby.
Yeah.
And everyone knows how to get on there. You just type my name and it'll come right up. It's on iTunes. If you get into iTunes, you can find the individual songs there. I've got a MySpace page.
Okay.
It's available on there. If you go on to MySpace, just type Dean Milano in. My page will come up. It's also available on my website, which is toysandcars.com, T-O-Y-S, toys-n-cars.com. So it's available all those places. And I always tell people, if you go on Google and just type in Dean Milano on Google, all my websites come up and everything, so you can find it within seconds. In fact, my latest song on my new CD is called You Know My Name, Google My Number.
In reference to the Beatles there, huh?
Well, that's, it takes it from that, you know my name, look up my number. But now, for modern computer people, it's Google My Number. And the song talks about all these people that the guy keeps running into who say, oh, I'm sorry I didn't call you, but I lost your phone number. And he says, hey, you know my name, Google my number. You know, you can find me within seconds. There's no excuse anymore, you know. And that's what the whole song's about. And, of course, at the end of the song, a woman he runs into says, you know, he had a little tryst with her, and then she says, how come you haven't contacted me? And he goes, well, I lost that. And she goes, you know my name. And so it twists it around on the guy.
Very good. So talking of the toys and cars thing you mentioned, so mm-hmm. One of the things that stood out, I'm looking at these pictures. There's a picture of you. I don't know how old you are. You got a birthday cake in front of you.
Oh, yeah.
Some kind of a van.
Yeah, a little jewel tea truck.
Then I see a more of a modern picture, right. And I see the same car there. Is that the same car?
No, we found that. My wife and I found that at an antique mall a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And I said, this is the little toy truck I had when I was a kid. And that's my fourth birthday. And I can remember clearly all summer long seeing that truck peeking out of the jewel tea delivery man's basket. So I can remember back to the age of 3.5. That's how far back my memory goes. And I can remember almost everything in my life, basically. You know? So that picture proved it to me. But then we found that toy in an antique mall, and we bought it. It was pretty expensive, too. And I said, I've got to have that toy again. I said, great, let's get it. And then I set that picture up there. I said, like, we've got to put the picture now. And I, on the website, it says, you know, something about how I love the toy so much that to this day I can't enjoy a meal unless I have my toy truck on the table with me. know?
Well, very good. Well, thanks again, Dean, for coming in. And we'll hopefully have some new podcasts coming out here in the near future. And I guess one more thing. If people want to see you play live, are you got any upcoming shows?
Yeah, I'm at Bill's Blues in Evanston. I'll be there on the 25th.
Okay,
with
great.
Jay Whitehouse on guitar with me. And Jay is a wonderful guitar player. And I think Carol Francis and Irene Kelly may come in and sing with me a little bit on that one, too. So that should be a lot of fun. And then I'm at the Espresso Coffee House. I know on December 1st I'm out there, and that's in Addison on Lake Street. I'm playing out there. And other than that, I'm just trying to find gigs someplace. I know they're out there somewhere. Everyone else is getting gigs, and I got to figure out how they're doing it. So if I can find something, I'm ready to play.
Well, we'll keep visiting your website and looking for those gigs on there.
All right, great.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay.